Welcome to the Month End CPG Community Chat. The Month End will provide emerging CPG brands real-life knowledge into the accounting, finance, and operational worlds. Our guests will be key stakeholders from those same brands, as well as other key contributors to the industry, all of which have vast experiences and insights that will be shared with the audience. Welcome to episode 11 of the Month End podcast. Today, we have Sunny McCracken from Opry. I'm very excited. I've known Sunny for several years and looking forward to the chat. How are you doing today, Sunny?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good, man. I love the swag hat there showing off for the video podcast here. I love it.
So, I know what I lack in a background on my wall, I make up for in a hat. There we go.
Awesome. So while we get started, let's chat about Opry. So what is Opry? What do you sell? How long have you been in the business? Just get a little high level elevator pitch on Opry so that the audience can understand where you're at or what you do.
Yeah, for sure. So the whole idea behind Opry kind of came up in late 2015, early 2016, when my then girlfriend, now wife, just to show the total progression of everything outside of the business too, came to me. She was looking for a clean and convenient snack to basically refuel her and keep her kind of satiated in the 2 to 3 hours between her workout class and her next meal as she's running back to the office. And at the time, she really had one or two options. She was like, either I'm going to be elbow deep in the office snack cabinet and eat a bunch of junk. And then she's like, why did I work out in the first place? Or alternatively, she, you know, doesn't eat anything. And then she's ravenously hungry at her next meal and then overeats. And so she's like, well, why did I work out in the first place? So the original impetus or genesis for this was really creating a healthy snack that could really deliver that 2 to 3 hours of satiation to bridge the gap between a workout and a meal. Since then, we've evolved and kind of, we have a plant-based protein drink, and that's like the core SKU that we ended up kind of launching into the market to solve this need that she had. But we've since seen it become a bit more agnostic around kind of when or why you should use the product. And it's kind of more of an anytime kind of mini meal. Whether it's, you know, in the pandemic, we've seen people using it as a quick kind of get up in the morning and I've got a million things to do, so I'm going to have it as a light breakfast to save me some time. Obviously, we have people using it as post-workout kind of recovery, and then we have people using it even to kind of solve the sweet tooth thing after dinner. It's been like getting back to the strategy behind why we launched this, though. When my wife came to me with this idea, I'm a former athlete, so I played football in college. So the intersection of fitness and nutrition was always kind of very important to me. And my response back to her around what she needed was she needed something that had a protein base to it, like something that was more protein forward. And as like a 5'3", 110 pound female, that's more of a lifestyle athlete than a performance athlete. She was very much like, protein, interesting, but I don't want to look like you. And, you know, like the way that you did in college with a football neck is what she called it. And that was kind of the first light bulb for me. It was like, wow, well, there's a totally different story about protein that you should be aware of. And it's not just about adding bulk and biceps and running faster, jumping higher. It's, again, it's crowding out those things that you would otherwise put in your body, giving your body kind of the nutrients it needs to be able to repair and recover as muscles, even if it's a low intensity workout. And she's like, okay, cool. So we ultimately found that there was a lot of people like her looking for these sorts of products, and what was currently out there in the market either had way too much protein and was unapproachable, or it had ingredients that were like, you know, 45 ingredients long, only half of them you could pronounce. And, you know, your daily vitamin and mineral blend, which she's like, I don't want a whole bunch of vitamins and minerals and shakes. The branding was off, and then the taste left a lot to be desired. So we felt there was a huge opportunity here to really kind of create something new and novel for this incremental consumer into the space, tell a different story about protein, launch digitally to test and iterate, and really kind of figure out what's working with the product and what's not. And yeah, serve this incremental consumer into the set, which is something that you hear retailers always being really interested in as well. So to me, it was kind of this series of light bulb moments around this opportunity that really sounded compelling enough for me to leave my job at the time to go chase it down.
Awesome. Yeah, we love leaving corporate jobs and go chase down the vision. Yeah, for sure. The dream, right? So number one.
Yeah, I will add that I was totally naive and ignorant. Like, I came from management consulting before this, and I thought that this was going to be as simple as like coming up with like a powdered blend, putting it in some water and screwing a cap on it and selling it. And ignorance is bliss, because I don't know that it would have been quite as easy of an opportunity to jump through and kind of, again, leave that corporate job to go do it if I knew how challenging it was going to be. But I'm really glad I did.
Yeah. It's definitely a learning process, and you know, from your management consulting days and your college days at Harvard. I think we're going to get a good little conversation here around some metrics and financials and things like that. So I'm looking forward to it. But it is amazing, kind of going back to the brand kind of background, you know, it is amazing how the different subsets or target markets there are within a specific, you know, protein drink. Like, what is it, the big bulk football guy, the weightlifter, but what about the yoga, you know, athlete that just wants a little bit of a performance, or not a performance, a lifestyle like hit. So it's interesting where that came from. So your role is a CEO. So like, how has that, was that always the case? Is it iterated? Like, what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, it really changes. We're still in the kind of, we'll call it like, we'll call it sub 5 million in revenue right now. So I think we're like, the way that I've heard the founder's role described to me is it kind of morphs and evolves over time. As you start out as a founder, like kind of like this product centric kind of problem solver, then you go to founder slash manager, where you start to bring on a team. And so founder slash manager slash like kind of like chief salesperson, where you're not just selling, you know, potential like customers on your product, but you're selling future team members, you're selling investors. So it's, you have to be the kind of ambassador and evangelist for your product and company. And then eventually you become an executive, right? You become more robust in your processes and kind of what you have in place. You kind of push down more decisions to your team as you get more comfortable with what's happening in a business. So you can focus on the big things that are going to make the most meaningful impact on kind of like what the, you know, total business outcome looks like. So for me right now, you know, I'm somewhere on that path and that evolution. Kind of still very much like the founder. Like, we're working on a ton of product development stuff right now, and I feel like that's where my spark, the original spark, still lives. Obviously, we've raised somewhere between $4 and $5 million. So the sales aspect, in terms of kind of painting the vision for what we're going to become, is still super important. Mm-hmm. But we also have a team of somewhere between 5 and 7 right now, depending on kind of if you count our core team versus extended team, working on this. So putting processes in place so it's not just a fire drill every single day is kind of that next evolution of me as a founder.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense from the kind of the evolution and what that looks like. And it's interesting, as you grow up in the organization, it's about hiring good talent and recruiting good talent. And for you and anybody in your space, recruiting talent, you have to sell them to work for Operate. Why Operate versus, you know, a competitor or somebody else? Additionally, the whole selling investors, I'm sure you haven't counted the number of hours that you've been in, thought about sales pitches, or not sales, thought about investor pitches, talk to them. I bet that's an unlimited number for you.
Yeah, totally. And actually, like, I've huge fan of bootstrapping. Like, obviously, the more of your business you can own at the end of the day, the better. And then just, it forces you, like, what is it? Like, you can unlock the most creativity by putting like very defined constraints on what you're able to do. And money is obviously the biggest constraint for early stage businesses, or at least so far that I've encountered. And I think probably most would agree with me there. But I actually found that investor convos early on in our life cycle were fantastic. I mean, first, it's really fun to meet new people. And then you get really smart people in the space asking you questions that maybe you haven't thought of. Again, I'm an outsider. I came into this world from, you know, a world that was totally different. And so I didn't know what I didn't know. And, you know, even if investors aren't telling you the answer, and even if you're going to screw up some along the way in terms of how you respond, you learn to think about things through their lens, which can be really helpful. So I actually really enjoyed kind of the process of getting to meet tons of people. Now that we have an investor team built out, and we have advisors, and we have, you know, people in the business, and I know more of what I'm doing versus where I was 4 years ago, I find them to be like kind of not quite as helpful and more of a drain on my time and resourcing. But at the end of the day, like, I am super thankful for the people that we have in this business that can, you know, provide more than just capital. And whether it's a, you know, a pat on the butt that's like here to celebrate your victories with you, or to kind of help co-solve some of the problems that you inevitably face, especially with this last year in COVID.
Definitely, definitely. moving on to kind of sales channels, and kind of, you know, where you started and where you are now. You know, you coming from the finance world, the management consulting world, like, I know you probably had a fantastic model and a mindset of this is how we're going to do it. This is the metrics. This is the cost to acquire customers is what it's going to be. So kind of go through your process where you were 5 years ago when you were putting that together and imagining this. And then all of a sudden, what decisions did you make? And now where are you at today from like a sales channel perspective? And kind of how has that evolved over time? And what are the decisions that you've made with that?
Yeah. Wow. Big question. It's again, kind of like everything I've answered so far, it's an evolution. When I first started out, my approach to building the business was like, okay, like I'm going to talk to as many people as I can that have been in the space, as possible to get an understanding of kind of like what the, you know, what the benchmark targets are, whether it's margin, whether it's velocity in a door, whether in digital, it's customer acquisition costs, or kind of all of those things, so that I could at least put something on like into a financial model and build a plan. Right. And like the one thing you know about your financial model or plan is that it's going to be wrong. And it's just, you just try to like limit the variance of how wrong it's going to be. And that's like, that's exactly what I did. And oh my God, looking back on it, it's so wrong. And I think every single model and projection I've put in place has been like wrong by like, you know, 10% plus like each direction. Right. So I think as I've gotten better at this, I've been able to kind of narrow it, but it's still like, you know, some channels are going to grow way faster than you expect and some are going to, you know, take more time. So that's one of the big learnings for me. But coming back to our approach on how we built the business and doing it in a fairly unique way, I think might be informative if there are any other kind of like really early or pre-launch founders out there listening. But we went digital first. Our whole approach here was we want to focus on this incremental consumer into the space. So we want to focus on younger kind of like customers that are primarily like who you'd find in a boutique fitness studio, right? So not exclusively female, but like more female and people that share the same, those sorts of values. And being able to go digital where you can tell a story around your product and around like why you might need this. And when you're changing habits or creating habits in the first place where they might not currently drink a protein drink because there's never been anything that's spoken to them in the past. And then you can bring them into the brand fold from there. And then you can look at repeat rates, which are super indicative of how well your product's actually working. One thing I learned is that customers, what they do and what they say they'll do are two totally different things. Mm-hmm. So being able to actually test and identify what's working, what's not pretty quickly, to be able to evolve your business before you go into more opaque channels like retail and some of these other things that are out there where you, it's really hard to tell repeat. You're like, wow, our velocity is killing it here. But are those all new consumers testing the product for the first time? And is there going to be risk that it's going to collapse if we, you know, 3 months from now, because maybe the product's not good enough or our packaging isn't working hard enough for us. So all of those sorts of things, being digital first was hugely helpful for us, and being able to create a financial model and a plan that limited the amount of complexity across channels such that we could really focus in on kind of what the data was telling us, what the consumer needs, kind of who and what the consumers were versus what we thought they were going to be and how they're using the product, which can then inform like how we really start to scale this business, was I think a move that I think that we made that was right, looking back retrospectively.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, especially if you're targeting more female folks or people to begin with. Like, you know, there's that emotional connection as well, which you can tell a better story emotionally through direct consumer, through social media and things like that. Back to modeling, did you have 5 years ago, did you model in a pandemic coming into play in 2020?
Yeah, very much no. Very much no. And I live in like, I kind of like one of my tips is like, I live in my model. Like my model is a live document. And I know a lot of other people, especially as you get to a more kind of established business, it's like you lock the model, right? And then you kind of distribute, you know, certain parts out to your team and you roll it up and, you know, you're like, okay, here's our financial plan for 2021. And let's go do it. And for me, because our team is pretty lean and I have a pretty tight kind of understanding of what's happening minute to minute across the business and what we're seeing. And because in retail, especially, there are so many binary decisions that can totally, you know, made by buyers at retailers that can totally swing the business one way or another very, very quickly. I've just made, you know, my approach to date so far has just been to have a live model that I am okay. If like our velocities are faster than we expected, let's go in and update the assumptions and see what that's going to tell us about the next 30, 60, 90, 180 days. And so that obviously informs production planning, all of that. Or if we're coming up short, maybe we have an opportunity to take some of the money for that channel and stick it in another channel to be able to reach the kind of reach the revenue targets. And one of my kind of growth points is, I think a founder is like, you know, it's very easy to like pound the table to your team, like sales, go out and just do it and come back to me once you've hit your numbers. And being more iterative with your team. And again, you have to be iterative with your financial model as well if you're going to be iterative with your team, has just been a huge unlock for the business and my peace of mind, especially in an environment like COVID where, you know, things are changing by a, you know, a drastic amount in very quick order.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good recommendation. You know, we see a lot of clients that, or even just folks in the business that have a model or they paid somebody $5,000 to put a model together. And they're like, I don't know what the hell this means. I don't know how to update it. What's going on? And it's like, you know, understanding. And I think what I try to tell and advise people is like, get something that works for you and then get in it, be in there periodically or frequently every Friday or every Wednesday and like start getting into understanding how things change, how assumptions can change different things. And then it'll become second nature to you to be in there and to do that, whether it's updating the model, whether it's updating your books and records, whether it's reviewing inventory reports or velocity reports. But I think that that's the key thing is, you know, at some point you are going to have to do it yourself or something you can do yourself. You can outsource a lot of things, but having those things at your fingertips that allow you to make decisions like and see data in real time and then make those decisions based on that data, it really helps out. And clearly that's kind of where you come from as well.
No, you're totally right. Like I barely ever go into QuickBooks. I go in there kind of at the end of the month or if I'm putting in invoices or things like that, but it's all the model. And I totally agree with you. Like if a founder isn't very financially sophisticated, like totally fine, make a simple model. And, correct. And like, that's where you start. And the model that we use today from a layout and kind of functional aspect is very, very similar to the first model that we started out with. It's just, we've been able to get the assumptions to be tighter. Yep. And so it doesn't like, I think eventually, you know, when we hire a CFO, we'll probably start the model from scratch and create something that's, you know, more CFO level, CFO worthy. But right now what we have, I mean, like the fact that I trust it, I know it, and I can like tweak it and improve it is like all I need right now.
For sure. Good. So then you started out direct consumer. Now you're in, you know, direct consumer, Amazon, distribution, club, studios, direct wholesale, yeah, studios, kind of like, you know, just kind of what is your favorite channel? Like, how do you view channels? Do you look at different metrics by channel? Just kind of give us like your mindset on looking at all those channels or kind of how you assess, each one of them.
Yeah. So I think the world that we're living in is very different than the world of 5 or 10 years ago. I think people before were very much like, are you a retail only business or are you a direct to consumer only business? The world that we're living in now is very much omni and I think it's the role and responsibility of the brand and the brand customer relationship to reduce the kind of amount of friction in getting the desired goods to the customer in the way in which they want to buy. And so for us, we are, as you mentioned, we're in so many channels. I'd say we're generating significant revenue from 5 channels. For like a brand at our revenue point, that's a lot of channels to be up and operating. And I wouldn't necessarily recommend being in 5 channels. But the way to think about it is that like it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, the channels all talk and compete against each other to an extent, right? So your pricing, you have to have fixed, like kind of pricing that makes sense across all channels. You can't have, you know, your direct, for example, our direct to consumer, when we were only direct to consumer, we weren't worried about pricing against the category. We were just pricing our product for our consumer. So our prices were way higher, which allowed us to have a much more sustainable margin in the business. But once you start rolling out into retail, the customer expectation is that the best price they're going to get is on your website. But your website is not necessarily the like lowest cost way to get a heavy beverage product out to your customers. So that, and then if you're going to be on Amazon, Amazon's going to price compete against your website too. And they're going to get better shipping rates than you. So there's a lot of challenges, right? Like they can really, in many ways, channels are competitors, but on the other hand, they do really help each other if you're doing it right. So for us, like we're in almost 500 fitness studios across the country, which is something that's really cool that we built up from scratch as a brand, having these like, you know, one-off cycle yoga Pilates studios carry our product. And 30% of our customer acquisition in digital was coming from fitness studios. Mm-hmm. So it's a profitable way to get the product out into the world and have it sampled and tested and like and like actually make money off of it and then drive people back to purchase in bulk on your website. Obviously, the same thing's going to start happening with retail too, right? You're going to see, you know, customers potentially stop buying online because their local Whole Foods carries the product or whatever. And so you got to be a little bit more flexible with how you approach the business. And that's like a big challenge, right? Like it's taking your marketing kind of allocation and resources away from just direct response advertising on digital to being a little bit more, having a little bit more faith and a little bit more trust that what you're doing and out in the world is actually going to drive impact across channels where you can't necessarily link it back like you can in digital, can be a real challenge, but you have to understand that like your strategy has to make sense across all the channels. And then you have to have faith that they're going to work together in a complementary fashion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely fair. It is interesting how they kind of interrelate and can be kind of a marketing driver from one channel to the other and back and forth. You mentioned that on your model, you know, you'll be kind of adjusting, you know, sales assumptions based upon actual, and some, you know, channels may not hit sales targets and other channels may go up. How do you handle it and integrate that with inventory, right? So managing inventory on hand, inventory at your warehouses, your 3PL, and then let's say that you need to get more to Amazon. Like, how does that work functionally from your, you know, looking at the model or real time? And how do you kind of process that or execute that for, you know, the team members that are the listeners here that are trying to understand kind of how you can kind of move inventory across different channels and 3PLs and things like that, just so people can kind of understand that?
Yeah, for sure. So my first answer to that, like, how do we manage it? I would say imperfectly. It's a real challenge, for sure. I mean, right now we're in the middle of a stock out. We have 4 flavors in market, and our variety pack, which is so basically 5 flavors, right? Because a variety pack's its own flavor, if you will. We're out of stock on like 2 or 3 flavors right now. So, so it can be really hard to manage. The other thing is, you begin to operate in more channels, is that you have different supply chains for each channel too, right? So we have a D2C 3PL that focuses on getting products and customers, but they were certainly not the right provider to service our wholesale customers, like the Costco's of the world, because they weren't sophisticated enough, couldn't be trusted. So now all of a sudden we have product not only at HQ, we have product in DTC warehouses, we have product in wholesale oriented warehouses, and it can be really challenging. You start moving, especially liquid product, around, it becomes really expensive and eats into your margin. So the way that we approach it here is, we do a revenue build for every single channel, and this is something that we update as frequently as possible. So whether it's D2C, which is, you know, our revenue build's a function of spend plus retention, so acquisition plus retention. Then in fitness studios, it's a function of the number of active doors that we have times the expected velocity of those doors. And then for each, as just 2 examples, and then each of those channels has like a kind of, you know, at first it's just lick your finger and hold it to the wind to try to understand kind of like what, you know, what your percentage breakdown of volume is going to be across different flavors. But as you start to see trends, then you can inform, okay, this channel actually, you know, our variety pack kills it, but we don't have a variety pack in retail. So mint chocolate, one of our lower, like kind of slower moving flavors, isn't going to do as well. So you just adjust kind of what your expectations are. And the way that I kind of handle it is, I actually put the inventory production in the model. So everything feeds into what our inventory needs are going to be, by like the individual bottle itself or by the flavor. And then we go and we try to produce against those needs while also thinking about the constraints around working capital, cash flow, and all of those things as well. So for us, our model is a cash model. So basically, the very last 2 lines of the model tell us like what the cash impact is of that month, and versus the dollars that we have in the bank. So we have a very clear understanding of runway, and that takes into account, you know, the channel, like the average kind of terms of the channel, right? So like retail, we're, you know, average net 20, I think, because we have a blend of net 10 and net 30. DTC, we're, you know, like somewhere closer to like less than 2 weeks. Amazon, we're around 2 weeks. So basically you can have like a very clear understanding of what your inventory needs are, and then what your kind of payback timing is going to be from each of those channels. So you can get like a pretty good kind of prediction on what your cash flow is going to be. And then you can use that to inform how much of each flavor you produce and how long you can afford to float your inventory.
I Love it. I think you lost a lot of people in this whole conversation, but
I'm sorry.
No, you didn't lose me. I think
you
this
get
is
me
great.
Deep into the model. And
no, I knew this. This is good because
you have to get back out.
Yeah, no, this is great. Because I do think like a couple things in that comment. Number one is like understanding that each specific sales channel that you sell in is a different business. It's a different model. It's a different metric analysis, a different reporting mechanism. Like, right, you have to have an understand. What is my margins in D2C factoring in freight out, you know, at this 3PL, as well as my, you know, advertising factoring in the, like, what is my turn on cost to acquire a customer? What's my lifetime value versus looking at unified Ks of the world? It's a completely different model, right? And it's a completely different inventory situation where you have to give them more inventory or not. And then how do you assess your velocity in that aspect? So just number one, understanding that. Number two, you know, reconciling everything that you're doing to cash. And this, this is what it does, right? You need to understand what's your cash cycle, when you're buying inventory, when you have to pay for inventory, when is that money coming in? And then kind of defining that or segmenting that within each specific sales channel as you're discussing, because then you can break out and really get a much more as precise as you can get it, Sonny, right? The model, yeah,
exactly.
By sales
guaranteed
channel,
to be like, wrong, hopefully just less wrong than it was
correct,
before.
Correct. Yeah. It's minimizing risk at the end of the day, right? So basically then kind of as we reconcile to that, like from a cash flow perspective, right? So then how are you factoring in cash flow and leveraging cash to buy inventory and to handle that and direct? So clearly you've kind of went through your model, but then in terms of handling that cash and buying inventory, when are you reordering? How often do you reorder? Kind of things like that in terms of, you know, 60 days, 90 days, like, you know, on demand, kind of how, what's your relationship with your co-man with that, as well as kind of how do you manage that aspect?
Yeah, that's a, again, it's a blend of, a blend of kind of best guess and like complex financial modeling, right? It's the first thing I'd recommend is that anybody that's kind of in market and has an established sales track record, especially if you have some kind of steady recurring revenue, either from DTC or existing customers that have, you know, you have a really stable business relationship with, I would go find a partner to finance your inventory. So for us, we were financing inventory prior to, you know, finding this partner that we're working with, by selling equity in the business, i.e. like raising money in our rounds, and then we would actually have cash out of the business off the balance sheet to our co-man for the product that they produce on our behalf. And then when we're sold down, it comes straight through to us. We're currently working with a partner that basically pays for our inventory for us and then charges us interest on the inventory. And then they basically take a percentage of sales back in. So it's a combination of like kind of DTC financing, AR financing, all of that, and then just general inventory factor financing. So there's that's been huge for us because it's allowed us to order slightly bigger runs and get, and because we have a scale-based pricing relationship with our co-packer, it's allowed us to expand our margins by producing inventory for a kind of longer kind of view out into the future all at once. And because our product has a pretty long shelf life on it, we're able to do that. Now, the other thing that you should think about when you're running a multi-channel business is kind of like what the shelf life requirements are by channel, right? So for example, retail, because you're selling into a distributor who then sells into a retailer, is going to require, you know, some percentage of your shelf life to be left before you sell them the product. Whereas DTC doesn't. Obviously, you don't want to be selling, you know, product to customers that's about to expire in, you know, weeks or even just like a month or 2 months worth of time. But you can think about shuffling inventory or excess inventory kind of away from one channel and into another, versus like trying to dispose of it or feeling like you're screwed. So I would just also think about that, kind of like having a waterfall of where your inventory goes first versus where it can be pushed out last.
Great information. I think I'm going to go back to you know, factoring or leveraging a partner to kind of, you know, debt financing, so to speak, across inventory factoring, PO, AR factoring, DTC factoring, right? Like, again, 5 years ago, these types of partners did not exist. You know, like getting access to capital now and cash flow loans and these types of arrangements are much easier now with the world we live in. A lot of people get blinded by interest rates or fees that they're doing. And you got to understand when you're doing that, like if you're not going to do that, you then need to raise equity, which then you're giving a percentage of your ownership away. So what is the fine line of that interest rate or debt rate, right? It really isn't that huge of a deal when you're small, as long as it's not massive, right? It's about kind of understanding that. But then I think the biggest thing that Sonny said here was that you can take that relationship where you're paying some interest and fees on, and then also then have a relationship with your co-man and possibly get a couple more points of margin on, because you're going to be more proactive in literally creating inventory or having them, you know, manufacture inventory as well as, so you can basically kind of get some savings over here while you pay more over here, right? So it's kind of understanding that aspect of how it can impact it and leveraging specific relationships or cash you have to maybe offset, you know, some of those interests in different manners. So just kind of thinking that process through, and at the end of the day, you know, having just kind of consistent inventory helps out clearly of just keeping customers coming through the door and things like that. So I think that is
nothing ruins a relationship with a customer, whether it's, you know, the customer is an individual ordering off your website or a wholesale customer like a Costco, like not having product when they need it, for sure. So it's huge to make sure that you have that product, but it's expensive to keep more product than you need. So the equation around kind of what makes sense regarding kind of third party inventory forecasting and just financing, not forecasting, and kind of the needs of the business come down to like the cost of capital and like how much could you get for how much of the business would you have to give up for that equity, rather than just having it be a cash kind of like a cash exchange around interest rates, what you can actually save if you produce more, to your point. And then finally, it's what your growth rate is for the business overall, right? If you're growing at a rate that's significantly faster than the interest rates that you're paying to support your business with inventory, then it makes a ton of sense to just finance that, for sure.
Yeah, I love it. This conversation's been awesome. We're nearing the end here. So Sonny, let's end here with one do and one don't. So what does one do to the listeners here in the Emerging CPG?
These are going to be funny because they might be a little bit double speak. But the first one is like, as a CEO, if you will, or as someone that has, you know, a lot of stuff going on across the business. Hold on one second. I actually just lost you on Zoom. Okay. Here you are. Sorry, I was getting a call. The first thing is like spend the time where it matters, right? And then hire good people to handle the day-to-day stuff. And the more important something is, or the more thought it takes, or the more kind of strategic direction your team needs, the more time you should be spending on it as a founder, the more kind of just, you know, kind of plug and play or just routine something is, the more you should not be doing it. But you have to have somebody you trust do it. Otherwise you're gonna be looking over their work, or if you don't trust it, you're not actually getting leverage into the business. So, for example, like a huge part of that is back office accounting, things like that, which we have you guys do for us. If we didn't trust you and I was having to go back through the financials every single time you guys did them because I didn't believe them, then that's not actual real leverage for the business. Nice. So make sure that you create time for yourself as a founder to do the things that are high impact and high thought, get other people to do the other parts for you. And the second, like the general don't, is don't introduce complexity where it's not needed. And this is something that is easier said than done. You're going to be presented with a million growth opportunities, and the more simple you can have your business. Like I remember when I was creating this, I'm like, okay, I'm going to put powder and water in a bottle and I'm going to screw the cap on. And then I'm just going to go out and I'm going to sell it to wholesalers and sell it digitally. And it's going to be easy. Complexity finds you, fire drills find you. And the easier and more simplified you can keep the day-to-day operations and strategy of the business, the more time you'll be able to have about how you can do it better, or what other things you can do. And then when you go do something different, or do something, add complexity into the business, just make sure it's a step change for the business, not a linear change.
Yeah. I agree.
Said by the guy that's in five channels and doing all sorts of stuff like, but yeah, I mean, that's the common trade-off that we have to make around opportunities for growth.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to have to iterate and identify opportunities and make decisions. But I think at the end of the day, don't add, you know, this is how we've kind of ran accountfully, is don't add complexity where it doesn't need to be, you know, added. It's just, it's a waste of everybody's time and energy and it's not productive. So I love it. I love your do. I love your don't. I love the story. I love this conversation in relation to, you know, much more focus on modeling and understanding inventory and kind of numbers focus. This has been awesome, Sonny. I really appreciate it. Before we leave, where can we buy Opre? What is your favorite flavors? What are on the horizon? Just kind of, you know, sum it up for us so we can get the listeners to go buy some product.
Yeah, awesome. We can be found on Amazon. We can be found on our website, which is drinkopre.com, drinkapres.com. Again, we're in 500 fitness studios across the country. So maybe you can find us at your local gym or fitness studio. We're about to roll out this summer with Lifetime Fitness across the country. So if you've got one of those near you, we'll give them a friendly plug right now. But yeah, it's a really exciting time for us. I feel like with COVID really impacting the kind of healthy on-the-go convenience category, like which is what our product kind of technically falls under. There's a lot of kind of defensive posturing that was happening last year, batten down the hatches, make sure we get through it and come out of it stronger. So now I think it's a really exciting time for our business to play offense, both in terms of driving, you know, more opportunity for our core SKUs to be out there in the world with new retail partners, which we have some coming up, which, well, if we're doing our job, we'll make sure that everybody hears about it. And we also have some new product thoughts too. And I think there's some really interesting things that we can do to help kind of bring, you know, bring better value to the lives of our consumers inside the protein category and out. So yeah, thank you, Brad, for having me on. It was a fun conversation. loved working with you guys at Accountfully. Loved always chatting with you. You couldn't be further from the dry accounting guy that they, you know, that the typical office space, you know, movie makes out to be. So it's fun to work with you and your team. Your team's the same. Really appreciate the good work you guys have done for the business. And thanks again for having me on.
Appreciate it. Yeah, we're sat downstairs in the basement with our stapler.
yeah, exactly. And your flair, right?
Awesome. All right, Sonny, really appreciate it. So that's episode 11 of The Month End with Sonny from Operate. Again, www.drinkoperate.com. Go check them out and I hope you enjoyed the chat.